Thanks, Angus, and it is a delight to be here again with Cedar. It's a delight to be here. I noticed in the John Hunter building in Hunter Street. In my spare time, such as I have, I'm writing a book on the transportation of convicts to Australia, which was all done by contractors, contrary to what the Prime Minister thinks, although I did correct, I didn't get a chance to get his wife to correct yesterday to correct him on that subject. And in the course of that, I've been reading more widely about it. And Hunter's a remarkable man. As you come in that coffee shop, there's a painting of Hunter as the older, as the governor, and he had an unfortunate governorship. But of course, he came out a second captain on the series with Arthur Phillips. And there's a wonderful story that really Australians should know about that hasn't been told about him. They arrive, of course, in January. In September, Phillips realises they're going to run out of food. And he says to Hunter, I want you to go to the Cape and get, you know, sort of pop to the corner store, I want you to go to the Cape and get some more food. He sails out in the Sirius, which is leaking, with half the crew, because the other half are behind trying to build settlers and grow some food. And of the crew, the half crew he does have, a number of them have already got scurvy because they've been on salt provisions for 12 months already. And he sails over the heads and turns right with a leaky boat, half a crew and half of them with scurvy, and says, will I go right or left? I know, we'll go round the world. And so these men proceed to sail round the world at about 44 degrees south. They spend weeks amongst icebergs. By the time he rounds Cape Horn, he's got only a handful of men before the mast because the rest are down with scurvy. And in fact, when they land, there's wonderful letters by a young midshipman on that who was writing letters to his parents and had been on the ship with these men for probably 18 months. And when they land at Cape Town, he has to take the names of the men who are being taken to hospital because he can't recognise them, they are so emaciated. I mean, just think of the courage and the confidence of a young man in his probably 20s, Hunter was at that point, in setting off in that situation to just pop over to Cape Town, around the world, and through iceberg to pick up some bread and milk. These are stories we should all know. Imagine an industry that accounts for 6% of GDP, but is regarded with suspicion and even hostility by the majority of Australian politicians. Picture an industry that makes a significantly larger contribution to GDP than the telecommunications sector, but is virtually never discussed in the press. Think of an industry where Australia has a significant competitive advantage on the international stage, but for reasons of government policy, we export virtually nothing. That industry is the public service industry. That part of the public service sector where services are delivered either to government or directly to us as citizens by the private and the voluntary sectors. To think of public services as a market with a discrete supply side and demand side is profoundly challenging. To think of public services as an international industry capable of paying taxes, earning export income, and transferring intellectual capital between countries demands that we undertake a paradigm shift. Flip through there. At the moment, we're somewhere like the Soviet Union about 1985. We have only ever known bread queues. We have erected a wall to prevent the flow of goods and services across our national borders. And we start with the assumption that vital goods and services are best provided by a government monopoly. And that's essentially the way that you and I think about the public service sector today is roughly equivalent to the way in which those people were thinking about public services, commercial services in 1985. In fact, most public services, policing and probation, fire brigades and ambulances, schools and hospitals, public utilities and social insurance, were invented by the private and voluntary sectors and only later taken over by the state. What government brought to the table was equity, a huge advance in terms of quality of life and social stability. But we leapt to the conclusion that equity could only be provided if these services were organised by way of a producer monopoly. That mindset is now changing. Some countries have begun to unpack supply and demand. Some countries have recognised the benefits of pursuing choice and diversity in public services. They are striving to create a mixed economy of public, private, and voluntary providers capable of meeting the growing demands of the public. And some countries have begun to break down the walls that we have erected around our public service sector, actively pursuing international best practice in public service delivery by encouraging the entry of foreign providers. 2 years ago, I sat down with a delegation from JETRO, the Japan Export Trade Organization, who had been sent to the UK to speak to public service providers to ask what would be necessary to encourage us to enter the Japanese public service market. Some countries have been actively commercializing their own public services, putting them in a much stronger position for export. And some countries have recognized that there is a first mover advantage in this market, and they are actively assisting their public service providers to export their services abroad. 6 weeks ago, the UK Secretary of State for Business led a delegation of business leaders from the public service sector to Washington to promote the UK industry. Now, Australia has commercialised one or two of its public services, freeing up private and voluntary providers, and indeed in some cases, public sector providers, to expand their businesses overseas. But for the most part, we have proceeded with great caution. And if my argument about the internationalisation of the public service industry is correct, then this diffidence is placing Australia at a serious disadvantage in these emerging markets. The best evidence about the emergence of an international public service sector comes from the United Kingdom. Late last year, the Secretary of State for Business, John Hutton, commissioned a review of Britain's public service industry, the first of its kind in the world. It was led by a senior economist known as D.M. Julius, hence the name of the report to which I'll refer, the Julius Report, and it was released in mid-July. The results surprised everybody. In 2007-08, the total revenues of the UK public services industry were £79 billion, generating value-add of £45 billion and directly employing more than 1.2 million people. That excludes public utilities such as water and electricity, which were privatised years ago and which the Brits don't think of as public services. It also excludes GP contracts, which is not an inconsiderable sum of money. There was a lot of discussion about where they should fall, and decided in the end to exclude them. In terms of value add, that is the same scale as food, beverages and tobacco and communication sectors combined. It is significantly larger than aerospace, automotive and pharmaceuticals combined. In terms of absolute size, the public service industry in the UK is second only to the United States. As a proportion of GDP, it is slightly larger than the US, significantly larger than France and Spain, and as you can see, slightly smaller than Australia and Sweden. It accounts for one-third of total expenditure on public services, again, much larger than any of us had guesstimated, the same as the United States, somewhat larger than Sweden and Spain. In terms of the level of investment and degree of market sophistication, however, the report concludes the UK industry is the most developed in the world. And while it's virtually impossible to measure, it is certainly the world leader in terms of export income. In terms of growth, over the past 12 years under a Labour government, the industry has grown by almost 130%, from just under 4% to almost 6% of GDP. From 1995-96 to 2003-04, it grew at 6.8% a year in real terms, levelling off somewhat in the past 3 years, with an average over those 12 years of 5.4%. On the demand side, the fastest growing sectors have been education, environmental protection and health. On the supply side, the industry is made up of six broad sectors: managed services, running prisons, providing employment services and the like, which makes up 44% of that figure; ICT, worth around $12 billion; business process outsourcing worth around $5 billion, construction services estimated at $2 to $3 billion, facilities management estimated at around $5 to $6 billion, and professional services, which includes consulting. As a result of this report, it is now universally accepted in the UK that this is a substantial industry, one that employs a significant proportion of Britons. And as one of those who helped to kick this inquiry off, I would add, and in brackets, a significant proportion of voters, one that must be built into the government's and is being built into the government's overall strategy for the service sector, and an industry that cannot be wished away with the ebb and flow of government policy or the changes of ministers or governments. The report made some broad comparisons with several OECD countries, including Australia. We just looked at that slide a minute ago. As you would have noticed, Australia is, according to these numbers, slightly larger than the UK as a percentage of GDP. The reasons for that aren't immediately obvious in the report. I think it's explained away by the fact that we have made greater use of private schools and hospitals. The Britons have done, in fact, on both cases, much less than us. It also reported that the public service industry in this country accounts for a significantly higher proportion of total expenditure on public services, but that was only because they concluded that we spent 22% less on public services as a proportion of GDP than America, which is a mad conclusion, and I pointed that out to the economic consultants, and they didn't think that deserved the attention, some serious attention. I'm not satisfied that the numbers here are right. But I do think it is reasonable to conclude that Australia has a public service industry of broadly similar proportions to the UK as a percentage of GDP. I think that makes sense. What is significantly different between Australia and Britain is the sophistication of market models and the range of sectors that are involved. Depending on how you count them, the UK now has around 700 to 800 public-private partnerships. Country that's six times the size of Australia, and it has somewhere, say, depends how you count, around 700 or 800. It has engaged the public service industry much closer to the core of government. For example, the Atomic Weapons Establishment is run by a private consortium that is developing, maintaining, doing the next generation of science on atomic weapons. And the National Physics Laboratory, for example, develops and maintains the standards for the time and mass and distance, Greenwich Mean Time, is contracted. And there are many others. Our next report, which is due out shortly, is on policing, documenting, really for the first time, the extent to which government has used contractors and civilians to free up warranted police officers so that they can do what only warranted police officers can do, which includes, for example, custody suites, police cells being run by private contractors, and scene of crime officers, the people who manage a crime scene being contractors and so on, and extraordinarily bold and very little understood in this country, just quite how far Labour has taken this. And finally, the British government is further ahead in contracting for outcomes, exploring radical new models in offender management and integrated healthcare. 15 years ago, when I first started going to the UK regularly, Australia was well ahead in terms of the commercialisation of its public service sector. Today, my guesstimate is that we're about 5 years behind, and that will be difficult to catch because they're not sitting on their hands. So why do this? What are the benefits to a country of commercialising and internationalising its public service sector? Well, let me deal with that in two ways. Firstly, by looking at domestic considerations and then at some international ones. The Julius report undertook no fresh research into the value for money gains from opening up public services to competition, relying instead on a literature survey commissioned by a leading academic. However, there's a significant amount of evidence on this question, and it confirms what we would all expect, that competition, and sometimes even just the threat of competition, can lead to significant improvements in efficiency. That really would not come as a surprise to anybody. The Julius Review and a much more comprehensive survey undertaken by the Institute last year confirms that the productivity savings are in the order of 10 to 30% and sometimes much higher. It isn't privatisation that delivers those benefits. The research tells us that in the vast majority of cases, it's competition that makes the difference. Productivity savings are delivered even when the in-house team wins the bid. The The impact on quality is much more difficult to study, but the Julius Review found that in general these savings do not come at the expense of delivery, and that in some cases competition has been used to deliver service improvements. The second great advantage of opening up public services to competition and internationalisation lies in the stimulus it provides to innovation. This is even more difficult to document, although as the Julius report points out, if competition is delivering productivity savings of 10 to 30%, then there's got to be some innovation going on somewhere. The difficulty with service innovation, and public service innovation included, is that it, for the most part, takes place through 1,000 small process improvements rather than one or two large technological breakthroughs. You do get those as well, but overwhelmingly, it's a lot of people at the front line iterating and experimenting and innovating rather than, you know, sort of huge R&D. One way of demonstrating the role of diversity and competition in contestability in driving innovation is to ask this question: what other than equity has government ever invented? I've been asking that question of a whole lot of people across the world on both sides of politics and for the last 6 months, and I'm always met with the same blank response. Name a major innovation in public services other than in the field of distributive justice, fairness, that government has invented. Now, a couple of caveats. I should make it clear I'm not minimising the importance of distributive justice. It is government's exclusive domain, and the private sector has virtually nothing to contribute in that regard. And let me make it also clear that this is not a criticism of government. It is a commentary about producer monopolies. Producer monopolies, public or private, aren't great on innovation. So name a public service that government has invented. Not policing. The modern concept of policing was conceived and implemented at the end of the 18th century by a crusading magistrate and a group of West India merchants. Nor the concept of the modern fire brigade. That was invented in the late 17th century by London's fire insurance companies. Not even the idea of a probation service, which was pioneered in Britain in the late 19th century by the Temperance Society. History confirms what we know from personal experience. Diversity and choice drive innovation, and that would not come as a startling proposition. What about the international perspective? Well, my starting point is the obvious one, that in commercialising and privatising our public services, we put them in a form where they're capable of being sold overseas and earning export income. The nation has made a huge investment over many years in the development of our public services, and in spite of periodic discontent, they are of high quality by international standards, and they are well regarded in OECD countries as well as the developing world. However, as presently structured, financed and marketed, there is no question that they could succeed in making the transition from domestic monopolies to commercial entities capable of assuming the risks associated with competition and contestability. Privatisation isn't what matters here. It's not essential, although in practice there are limits to how much commercial risk taxpayers will be willing to bear and how much they are prepared to invest in ongoing research and development. The capacity to survive in a competitive environment is, however, essential so that the creation of a local mixed economy where public, private and voluntary providers compete is necessary precursor to internationalisation. And, of course, private providers are dependent on the creation of a local mixed economy too, and the transfer of skills from the public sector to acquire the expertise they need to succeed in the international marketplace. The creation of an international public service industry will also facilitate the transfer of best practice across jurisdictions. At present, that transfer mostly occurs at the policy level and then only to a limited extent. For the most part, our public service managers are denied the opportunity to study overseas models at close quarters and adapt them to local conditions. When the US Federal Bureau of Prisons introduced radical new models of prison management in the 1970s, there was a great deal of interest amongst the correctional community around the world. And in the prison service in the UK, they were able to imitate the physical layout of this new generation of facilities, but they were not in a position to adopt the managerial reforms that went along with the new physical design. Public sector unions were unfamiliar with the concept of direct supervision, as it was known, which would require their members to work much more closely with prisoners day by day, all day, even to the point of eating their meals with the prisoners. And they strongly resisted that kind of innovation. The introduction of competition into prison management in the late 1980s was crucial to the transfer and adaptation of these new management techniques from North America into the British system. Interestingly, the selection of a security company with a Scandinavian background as the first private prison manager had another unexpected impact. Group 4 had always adopted an enlightened approach to human resources, but when it opened its doors at the Wolds, a male remand prison, the first private prison in the UK, 1/3 of the prison officers were female. The norm, the average in the public sector at the time was 3%. Radically different approach to running a prison. And then finally, deeper markets. The creation of an international public service industry will have the immediate effect of deepening markets, enabling providers to retain individuals with specialised skills by using them overseas. As long as care is taken to establish a predictable pipeline of bid opportunities, internationalisation will serve to deepen the pool of available expertise rather than leading to a brain drain. So, why not do this? What's the case against commercialising and internationalising? Well, let me just deal with a couple of objectives. Obviously, there are a lot, but deal with a few. Equity. One of the distinguishing characteristics of most public services is that they raise significant issues of equity or social justice. And since markets are not particularly good at delivering deliberative justice, won't commercialisation result in a decline in fairness? Well, not if we get the design right. And since it's been a centre-left government in the UK, in the world indeed, that's been leading this rather than a centre-right government, that ought to be a bit of a hint that creating an international public service industry, commercialising the public service sector, doesn't need to compromise equity. And if you get the design right, if you get the design of your market right, then you can ensure that your equity issues are not compromised. Consumer choice isn't appropriate in some public services, such as prisons. The idea of prison vouchers is just a tad challenging. And yet governments have successfully used the private sector in the management of custodial facilities through the use of exclusive service contracts. You know, choose your model. Some governments want some public social services free at the point of delivery. Again, they can be purchased from the private sector under contract, or they can be procured from voluntary sector providers through the use of grants and subsidies contracts, as indeed they have been for decades. And the public expects that some public services will be the same no matter where in the country they're provided. And again, in the UK education sector, the government has contracted with the private sector to come in and turn around failing local education authorities on the condition that they improve the standard and bring them up closer to the national average. That's been the term of the contract. In some cases, contractual or market solutions can actually assist the state in delivering fairer outcomes. In some cases, the demands of social equity can best be met through taxation and social security rather than through a public sector monopoly. And when it comes to personal services such as home care assistance to the disabled, universal provision by local authorities, the UK system, has actually resulted in inequitable outcomes because, in fact, the services are so personal that they're not universal and they need to be tailored in order to produce equity. In a similar vein, it's been argued that the commercialisation of public services will weaken the professional ethos that is an inherent part of the public service delivery. This objection really only applies to frontline public services. UK research, and I'm sure the Australian research would tell us the same, that the most common public descriptors of public services are bureaucratic, infuriating, and faceless, while the least commonly mentioned terms were, in this particular survey, friendly, efficient, honest, and open. So no one's seriously suggesting that the public sector would not benefit from a private service ethos when it comes to back office services. But the story is very different when you turn to the front line. I mean, the public's more reticent about engaging the private sector when it comes to police officers, firefighters, doctors and teachers. And yet Australia's has got a vigorous private education sector, and it's the popularity with parents would suggest that they rate the service ethos of teachers in the private schools at least as highly as teachers in the public system. Denmark has a private fire and emergency provider, and for the most part the people of Denmark aren't even aware of that. It has a very strong public service ethos. And in the UK, the Labour government used the contracting of prison management to drive through what it called its decency agenda, which was actually being resisted by the public sector union. Well-designed and well-executed public service contracting can be used to infuse There have been some arguments raised that argue that, that contracting can compromise quality, and the answer is yes, it can, if those responsible for market design and contract procurement don't care about quality. If government is preoccupied with cost reduction at the expense of service delivery, then it doesn't matter whether the service is provided by the public sector or the private sector, quality will suffer. Public services may well work well in theory, some argue, but in practice the public sector lacks the capability to do it well. These folks are inclined to agree that contractual incentives are in fact more potent than bureaucratic incentives. And they say that's actually the reason why you've got to be extremely careful where you use them. And again, I don't disagree with that proposition. But it's an argument for embracing commercialisation and contracting wholeheartedly. It's a reason for designing deep markets and building capabilities through repeat business. It's an argument why you shouldn't just dabble at the edge. And finally, some would argue that Australia is too small to serve as an incubator for successful international public service companies. The available evidence suggests that size of the domestic market is not a reliable indicator of which countries will succeed in providing a platform, a springboard for the internationalisation of their public service. The experience of Transurban and Macquarie Bank in overseas markets for PPP toll roads is proof that Australia is not too small to serve as an incubator for international public service companies. The success of INGIS and Mission Australia in taking a leadership role in the European welfare to work market proves that Transurban's experience was not a one-off. My favourite example in demonstrating that size doesn't matter is an historic one. The Dutch, who dominated hydraulic engineering across Europe for more than 500 years, not just windmills, which were a fairly late invention, but canals and ditches, sluices and dikes, this massive international transfer of technological and organisational expertise was led by private entrepreneurs who profited from it commercially. The Dutch polders and farming districts reclaimed from the marshes were constructed and managed by private companies, financed by private capital. And they weren't just selling technological know-how. These drainage works needed to be project managed. They needed to be regularly maintained. The little boy with his finger in the dike, if you remember that story, was doing early O&M on a PPP. And they had to be organised so that the farmers and the villagers all undertook their share of the work. The Dutch pioneered new capital raising techniques, and they exported those to Britain and North America. They exported hydrology management throughout the known world, initially to Germany, then to Italy, France, England, Russia, Spain. Now, of course, the Dutch had made a virtue of necessity. We know that story. But that's only part of the story. Germany was also covered with vast wetlands that the Germans didn't invent a hydrology industry. They imported it from the Dutch. The Dutch discovered that they had a competitive advantage in a particular cluster of public services, and they exploited it. They recognised that there was a first-mover advantage in the internationalisation of hydrology services, and they took full advantage for half a millennium. And that's the primary lesson, I believe, from the Julius Review of the UK's public service industry. There is a first-mover advantage in the internationalisation of public services. Those countries that move first free up the vast pool of human capital tied up in the public service monopolies. And those that do that first will enjoy a significant commercial advantage in the emergence of these international public service markets. The Americans dominated the first generation of prison contracting because they moved first. The British have exported their model of public-private partnerships to the world and given their companies a huge advantage in international markets because they moved first. We actually did it earlier than they did. We just simply did not develop them. We didn't do it long and deep enough, and we didn't develop a model that could be exported. Australians have played a disproportionately large role in toll road financing and management in Europe and North America because we moved first. In failing to recognise the huge investment tied up in our public services and its capacity for commercial exploitation, in denying public service managers the opportunity to innovate through commercialisation and exposure to competition, in refusing to restructure them so that they are in a position to take advantage of the internationalisation that is going on. We deny this country a significant source of export income. We prevent the best of our public servants from reaching their full potential. And we close ourselves off from the international trade in best practice that will accompany